Beloved MTV VJ, music exec, and radio personality Matt Pinfield has spent almost four decades in front of and behind the mic. He signed bands, interviewed Beatles, and had songs written about him. But now, he's having a different conversation. He's talking with friends and supporters across the entertainment industry about their journey and how he's found his voice again, being open about his recovery. This is Sound, Sobriety, and Success.
Hey, welcome to Sound, Sobriety, and Success. I'm Matt Pinfield. I'm really excited about the show today because I have a dear friend of mine who, man, I've been a fan of his ever since I saw him perform live. I was about 17, maybe 18 years old, and I saw his band, the Stray Cats, play in Asbury Park, New Jersey at a place called the Fast Lane. I had bought their records on import because I thought they looked so interesting and cool. And of course, he's incredible. He's the legendary drummer of the Stray Cats. Of course, they led the charge with incredible rockabilly revival that happened in the late 70s, early 80s. And he's been doing so many great things since then. And you know him from his, I mean, he's just known as that guy who plays the drums standing up and just has that complete command of the stage. I'm so happy to have him here today. And I'm talking about Slim Jim Phantom. Jim.
Hey, Matt.
It's great to see you, man.
Oh, shucks, man.
You know?
Yes, we've known each other a long time.
Yeah.
And 82. How old were you in 82?
82. I think I was just, at that point, I was probably about 20, something
yeah,
like that.
21 yeah. For me.
Yes.
Yeah, so, I was born in 61.
Yeah, so you and I were actually born the same year, but I think we were born a few months apart. That's what I understand.
That's amazing.
Which is amazing to me because there I was. You were already, at a young age, like just playing the club scene and going into New York City. Like, I know I started going into New York City in the days of like CB's, mm-hmm. but I mean, you were absolutely living it. Let's talk about, Jim, you growing up and you're born in Brooklyn, but talk to me about you as a kid and discovering yeah. rock and roll and loving it.
I was born in Brooklyn and my father's a fireman, New York City. And, Irish Catholic background, same as
me.
A lot of people in the neighborhood.
Yeah, yeah, right.
We moved to Long Island. I grew up in Massapequa, Long Island. Moved there when I was 3-4 years old. So it says on my birth certificate, Brooklyn, in a hospital that's not there anymore.
Yeah,
Midwood Hospital in Flatbush. But we spent every weekend usually. We spent a lot of time in Bay Ridge with my mother's people, but I went to school and everything was on Long Island, Massapequa. That's yeah. always in the news for one wacky thing or another.
Yeah, it's true. And that's where you met Lee Rocker, of course.
Yes, Lee and Lee Rocker, Brian Setzer, are both from my school. Both, we all grew up together. Lee and me are like you, 1961.
Yeah.
It's Lee's birthday, August 3rd. So whenever this airs, happy birthday, buddy. Brian's two ahead of us. I'm in March 61. Lee is in August of 61. So we were in the same grade, which now it doesn't really matter when someone's
yeah.
97 years old and someone's 95 years
yeah,
old.
Yeah, right, exactly.
Matter.
You get a little
but
older.
When you were 13 yeah. and when you were 11, or when you're 15 and you were 13, then it really mattered. So Brian was always a guy that we knew. He was always the best guitar player in town. And when a little bit we were old enough, we all started to play together. Lee and I had always played together in every incarnation of what we did.
Well, you started in bands when you were like 14, 15?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Lee and I would, we had a band that we wrote the songs for. We had another thing that we would play with some blues guys who were a little bit older than us, and we were the young kids who practiced a lot. Really, we all took lessons on Long Island, Massapequa Music Store, and then later for me, from a guy named Mousie Alexander who lived 5-6 train stops away, I think like Valley Stream or Merrick, one of those going that way towards Penn Station. And Lee and I were the kids that put a lot of hours into it. We would be his garage or my house. One goes boom, one goes bop. He played yeah. the bass, I played the drum. We practiced along. So, and we just were tight together.
Yeah.
Really. And that's, and then a few years after that, this would have been 1979. We're still kind of young. We found rockabilly music in a funny way. Combination of looking at old records, Beatles, Stones, who's C. Perkins, who's B. Holly, who's...
Yeah.
The Buddy Holly movie came out too. I think that was a big one. That was like 78, 79. Linda Ronstadt was on the radio, I remember. It's So Easy, Maybe Baby, B. Holly. So rockabilly was starting to
drift
onto my... And
you saw those credits, right? Like Carl Perkins on Honey Don't and Everybody's Trying to Be My Baby.
Exactly right. Whereas before then, maybe I was just playing along, just learning the drums, just being into everything. And however old it takes, how many times you have to play the same record till you start becoming album liner.
Yeah.
Liner note guy.
But yeah, like the young people don't realize today, I think, or just people in general, that it's great because you can be tutored online with YouTube videos on how to play things. But back then, you used to have to drop the needle to learn that one part and keep dropping it, ruin your record, basically, or your needle, so that you could learn how to play a song, right?
Yeah, and also slowing it down to 16 or
45 to 33,
ruining the record, I'm sure. But we did learn them. I had some older cousins who I'd borrow records from. And really, it just was a natural thing of digging deeper. Allman Brothers records, so you find out who T-Bone Walker was and Willie Dixon, and like all around the same time when you were good enough at the drums to start even considering anything else but practicing. Like now you're getting a little bit of a style and a taste for it all.
Didn't you also, it's like, you know some jazz stuff too, so you're listening to playing every style of music, right?
Well, I think anyone who lived around us, there was and certainly in my family, there was a requirement that if you want to do this, you have to take lessons and you have to do it right. And I enjoyed it. All of us did.
Yeah.
All the Stray Cats guys, we took lessons and we were, pretty good at it. There was five guys in my school that probably played faster than me, but we had a good feel. And then we started to develop a certain style. And I really have to credit the final straw for me being when I found Elvis Presley, the roots of Elvis Presley. Before that, we were getting into it. C. Perkins, B. Holly, and of course, you knew who Elvis Presley was. It's been 1978. He had already passed away. But I didn't really know about the origins of Elvis Presley.
Right. I mean, you knew the hits that were played on like CBS, oldie station.
And it was good. I liked Burnin' Love. I liked Heartbreak Hotel. I liked the conceptual thing of it all. I didn't really know. And very quickly when I heard the Sun Sessions record, That's All Right Mama, Blue Moon of Kentucky, and then got that record, my life pretty much changed almost immediately.
Yeah.
I think maybe even the next day or the day after that.
You were telling me once that, how you'd even changed your look at that period of time. Because you were part of the regular, like, rock and roll thing that was happening.
Yeah, I changed my whole life. I took the train into the city to St. Mark's Place.
Like Trash and Bowville and places like that.
That's involved. And the first place I went was a place called Hair Power.
Yeah.
And I cut off all my hair. I looked like Peter Frampton. I went in looking like Peter Frampton, and I came out like Elvis Presley's first album. Peter Frampton's an awesome guy, too.
He is a great guy, isn't he? Young, I love that, too.
But that's the imagery, if someone's trying to imagine my story. So I stopped at Hair Power and cut off all my hair. And it was a gum-chewing, new wave gal. I said, well, it's about time. she was cool. Said, imagine whoever was in the city, 79 hairdresser. Then I had a Elvis Presley pompadour, still with my tennis shirt, my flares, and my Adidas. I walked across the street to Trash and Vaudeville and got a pair of blue suede D-ring creepers. So now I had my hairdo, my creepers, still with my flares and my tennis shirt. I walked down the street a little further, Cheap Jacks. And I got a pair of what we would call them Ricky Ricardo pants.
Yeah, those pants that you would wear on I Love Lucy, right? With his band leader.
So I had the pants, I had the shoes, and now I still had my tennis shirt. The last one was Cheap Jacks, where I got a bowling shirt and a fleck jacket, we call them, like an old suit jacket. And I was complete.
Yeah, that's amazing.
And I just went home, and that's... They were a bit shocked, everyone, but I didn't even really reckon what anyone thought or
care at that point.
No, it's just whatever I would have done from that point, whether it was working at the liquor store or maybe music school or maybe get a job teaching drums, that's what I would have looked like.
That's amazing. So tell me about
that. I would have been that guy.
And then how did Lee Rocker and Brian Setzer follow once you, were you the first one to come along?
Well, no, Brian was a little bit ahead.
Because he was in a band, the Bloodless Pharaohs, for a while.
New wave band who were excellent. They were very, very good. And we used to go see them play all the time. He got into rockabilly a little bit before, and he used to do what became the Stray Cats by himself. He had a rhythm box, and he would play guitar. And since we, on Long Island, everyone knew each other, I would go and see everyone that you knew who was in a band. You'd go to their gigs. And I saw him do that, and I thought it was a great idea. I got into the music. I was at the same time finding Elvis Presley's records and finding the rockabilly records that were attached to the classic rock records that my cousins had lent me. And Brian and I have known each other since we were kids as well, but he's two ahead of us. So now I was old enough to get into the bars kind of thing. And I said, this is great. And one of the next times that he turned up to do his thing by himself, I had changed my look. I was now rockabilly guy.
Yeah.
Dude, drummer, Jim, yeah, it's me, yeah, yes, of course. Let's do this thing together. Yes, we are. And I, simultaneously speaking with Lee, who is my childhood friend, who Brian also knew his whole life, turning him onto it, double bass, which Lee as a musician really appealed to him, was a different thing. And it was kind of organically born at that point. And I think we all continued to do our other bands. Lee and I had a band and Brian had a band. And what became the Stray Cats was kind of like a weekend thing when you couldn't get the gigs at Max's Kansas City and Seabees, because they weren't that often.
Yeah, because there were only so many places
they draw.
To play.
Okay. Right. Yeah. And the rock clubs, they didn't know what the Stray Cats were. It wasn't even punk. It wasn't even new wave. It was kind of too wacky for punk clubs as well. So we made up our own scene, which was more or less what we, you would know it, old man bars.
Yeah.
There weren't music venue places. We would have a little PA and we would make an arrangement with the owner / bartender usually. We'll pack it out with some kids. You keep the bar, we'll charge at the door kind of thing. And we did very well. We had regular kids who didn't look rockabilly and no one else really went for the look except the three of us. But 5 nights a week on Long Island, different places. We played 2-3 sets every night. So we were very good at it. So that was our life. Brian and I shared an apartment the size of this room, maybe this room's a little bit bigger than we're doing the interview in. And we had a very nice life. We went to thrift stores, we slept late, we went to the diner, we did gigs every night, and it was kind of cool. But we knew that there wasn't, we kind of wanted to make a record, and we didn't even know how to go about any of it, but we would get NME, Melody Maker, 6 months late, whatever,
yeah,
you know, kind of things, import record stores and all that. And we knew that some of these records that we were getting, including Gene Vincent, Eddie Cochran, maybe even the Sun Sessions, were on import.
Yeah.
Because I think a lot of them were out of print in the States.
So that you could buy the imports from England or Europe.
Getting, Euro. Gene Vincent, I remember, was a French one. So we're getting these American artists that we thought was our own culture through import. So we thought maybe over there they already know what it is. Let's go to England. Okay.
That story's amazing about this. And I wanted you to tell everybody this story. But the name Stray Cats, I got to ask you, was that come from Stray Cat Blues by the Stones? Or was it something that hybrid? What was it?
It was kind of none of it, to be honest, which we knew that song. And I have to admit that we were very young. We had not that many records.
Yeah.
Right? And I remember I had a cousin who had the Rolling Stones live record.
Yeah.
Get your ya-ya's out, right?
Yeah.
And the version of Stray Cat Blues on that is very slow.
Yeah.
Comparatively to the one that we know from
Beggar's Banquet.
Beggar's Banquet. So I didn't make the connection because Stray Cats, it was very lively and all that. And the name didn't come that way. We were called the Tomcats in the beginning. And when we were in London, we had nowhere to live. We were homeless, virtually.
You literally lived. Literally. You guys lived on the streets.
Yes, yes.
Which is what I want people to know. I mean, before you put out and got your record deal and did your first single, you guys just went over there as kids and said, "Hey, England I think they love rock and roll. Let's go. And you lived on the streets, which is amazing to me. I mean, it's a great story.
So that's where Stray Cats kind of came from, when we had a little interest and were asked, what's the name of your band? Somehow, and I think it was Lee that came up, the Stray Cats sounded a bit realer than Tomcats.
Yeah. So
it could have been either, really.
Yeah.
But in another good part of the story, it was just the right thing to say at the right exact
time,
point in time.
Yeah.
So Lee Cat, Stray Cat, that's our name. Because they were asking us our name, and we were hesitant because we weren't. One person asked us, and Lee answered Stray Cats, and that's a good one. And it's harder to think of a name than it really is. It's easier to write an album, probably, or write a book than it is to come up with the actual name.
It is. I mean, it's incredible
the thing ever.
How hard that is. But tell me about that. There's a great story about, you know, how you went over there, you were trying to get gigs and play whenever you could, and basically, you know, I mean... You guys, you ran out of money, right? Didn't you guys go to like $200?
Yeah, we went with virtually nothing. We thought it was a good idea, and that was part of the argument. You said it was a good idea, and you said it was a good idea.
Which I just think is so great.
I think we like high-class hoboed it part of the time. We would meet, that's when I was just back in London. I went through a certain route by a taxi to get somewhere, and like a few places started hitting memory chords with me, and like a few times we were literally standing around on the street in front of a gig or in the afternoon someplace, you gravitate to Piccadilly Circus where there's other hobo. And two or three times people saw us and asked us about ourselves because we're there a bit ropey looking, you know, we're in a pink suit, you know, probably the same clothes that I got from Trash and Vaudeville because it wasn't that, we still had the same clothes. But we looked kind of like rumpled, but very young. We looked like you would say, who are you guys? And two or three times, the kindness of strangers, people took us home with them, which I don't know if it would happen in this day and age. If you see a guy at the 7-Eleven, are you going to ask him his story?
Yeah.
With two of his friends and say, come back and stay at our house in like a nice place.
It's a different time, right?
It's just not going to... I guess we looked harmless enough, but like mean enough, what we were trying to be. But so a few times, and that happened for maybe a week each time until welcome was worn out or we knew it was time to leave or something else was happening where we actually got a gig. So, but there's, I guess the ultimate part of the story is that there's nice people out there and everything is some part of some story, really. I don't know if it's pre-written or I don't even really know all that kind of stuff. I don't think about it too much, but I know we worked really hard and luck is opportunity meets preparation kind of thing.
Yes.
So, but there were a few organically nice people there.
Which is a great thing.
Come home and stay at my flat, you know, some guy, two or three times, 2 hours remembering. And during that time, a few other things happened.
And let's talk about those. One of those things happened to be this incredible gig that you guys ended up doing in the afternoon where all these names and people showed up for this gig. Explain that story because I love that one. Well, it was kind of a life-changing. There were a couple really interesting life-changing moments in the story of Slim Jim Phantom and the Stray Cats that happened there in England. And you guys are just young dudes right there, you know? Literally 19, right? I mean, you guys were kids. So tell me about that one gig, because it's amazing the people that showed up there.
There was a few of the gigs. It's a couple of well-known stories, but it's spread out over maybe a two-week period. There was a circuit of rock pubs. There was the Golden Lion, the Greyhound. They were both in Fulham. There was one that was called the Thomas A. Beckett Pub that was like a boxing pub. It was like straight out of Quadrophenia. It was a boxing ring, and then there was a venue behind it.
Yeah.
There was Dingwalls. There was the Marquee. There was a place called The Venue that was in Victoria Station. And they were all, especially the pubs, they were just on a circuit.
Yeah.
And they needed people to play there the same as you needed people to play at the Whiskey. You needed people to play at Cat Club. You needed people to play at the Viper Room. It was a circuit. The difference there being that these pubs, everything started in the afternoon. So there would be four bands playing. The first one would start at 4 o'clock in the afternoon because everything in England was finished by 11 o'clock at night.
Yeah.
So whoever was the more popular band or whatever would go on last. So we just knocked on enough doors and hung around these places hearing that this is where the play, the golden line, the Greyhound. I can't remember the part of how we would have gotten around to each thing, not knowing where we were and not having any money, but we somehow got to these places and knocked on enough of the doors that a few of them said, okay, you can play next Saturday at 4 o'clock in the afternoon. The other place, okay, you can play next Thursday at 4 o'clock. So we had about four or five of these gigs. And at the gigs were the scenester people that would be at these places every night or most nights when there was a little bit of a buzz about some band. And that was Lemmy, Chrissy Hynde, Glenn Matlock, Paul Cook, Captain Sensible, Dave Vaney, and whoever that.
Yeah, so exact like members of the gang, Damned, right?
The Damned, the Clash, the Pistols, Pretenders.
Yes.
And some other, who was ever in London 1980 at that level.
I mean, Motorhead, everybody. Yeah.
Everyone. Lem was one of the first ones. They would have kind of been there anyway in a funny way, but I don't know if they would have got there 4 o'clock in the afternoon, but there was a little bit of buzz. And we had been hanging around these places, going to parties, inviting ourselves, being outside of a stage door kind of thing for a few months before we managed to get these few pub gigs. So without specifically calling them on the phone, there was a little bit of word that, these guys that are hanging around, who are like, these guys from New York are playing, they're finally playing a few shows. Maybe they're good. Maybe they're not good. Maybe they'll play and go home. Maybe it was all that. So you're going to be there anyway. You got there an hour earlier and saw the Stray Cats play. And of course, that's when we knew play for 20 minutes in front of anyone, let alone if they were, we can do a gig for 20 minutes and no problem. So there's those who, by the way, each of those people are still my friends and I still stay in touch with everybody. 4 o'clock in the afternoon, just imagine you being there.
Yeah.
And the Stray Cats come on and do the whole thing. Yeah. Standing on the drum, spinning the bass, jumping into the audience, arguing with each other. The whole thing in 20 minutes. For the first time you've ever seen it. There was no template for it.
Yeah.
So those few gigs lead to like a few more, and that was a run. So after the first gig, by the time we did the fifth gig kind of thing, there was some heavy weights there. And one of the shows, it was an evening show at this point, not even that late in the evening, the Rolling Stones had heard about it.
Yeah.
And we did a show that they're all at a table. And before that, when you're playing and Strummer is there, Lemmy is there, the guys from Madness, that kind, gang that was coming, then it's really, really cool. And it makes the NME and it makes Melody Maker.
And Sounds, all those magazines.
It makes all that.
Yeah.
And there was a little bit of a buzz, so maybe that's how the Rolling Stones hear about it. But the Rolling Stones coming, that's in a paparazzi photo. I'm still friends with the guy who took the photograph, Richard Young. He's still a photographer in London.
Yeah.
When it's a picture of the Rolling Stones coming to see you, it transfers from Melody Maker and Sounds and NME into the Daily Mirror.
Yeah,
The national newspapers. That's really, it goes out of the music newspapers into the national newspapers.
Yeah.
And that's when every record label, everyone reads the national newspaper, especially in England, and boom, boom, who's the Rolling Stones? Why are they with this band that no one's ever heard of? So that's when again, it's all when we had these run of 10 shows around London. The last few, all the labels start to come. And it was an immediate kind of reaction to it.
It was unbelievable. You ended up working with producer Dave Edmonds. Who
Yes.
So great, Dave Edmonds. His first hit that I remember here in America was his cover of A Hear You Knockin', which he did so great. And then Zeppelin signed him, Peter Grant. He put a bunch of great records out on Swan Song. But he's always been kind of associated with that great classic, like original roots rock, which I love about it. And country.
Yeah.
And you guys did a country duet with him of George Jones, The Race Is On.
Yes. Dave Edmonds.
Yeah.
He was one of the people that came to the second, third, fourth, fifth shows. And he had been to a number of them, I think. Without us knowing, because I don't know how much any of us really knew him.
Yeah.
Maybe if you were pressed and someone played I Hear You Knocking. Oh, I remember that one. It was on the radio. But he made himself known to us, and we went to his house and met him, and he had a fantastic little house in the west part of London, and a little, you know, everything in England is just like littler.
Yeah.
Had like a finished basement with a small pool table and a small jukebox, like Long Island.
Yeah.
Everything was just smaller. Little jukebox, a little pool table, a little kitchen. It was a very cool house, but he had a jukebox and he had The Races On, was on the jukebox.
Yeah.
So we thought. But at the same time, there's labels around, and it just all managed to thread the needle where I think everyone wanted us, and we could have gone with different labels, various producers, but to get it all together, because you have to remember, during this whole time, all this exciting stuff, we still have no money, and we still have nowhere to live, and we still are hoping that the pub would feed us before the gig kind of thing. It managed to work out with Edmonds that it was a perfect storm. One of the labels, Arista, Simon Potts, Tarquin Gotch, guys that I still know to this day, they were the A&R. They had the power of the label. They had the power of the checkbook. Those guys, because the straight cuts could have gone anywhere. They had that. Edmonds, it all kind of lined up. If you get Dave Edmonds and it goes with Arista, then we will do this. And it just lined up.
Yeah.
Where that's what we accepted. And we went in and cut Runaway Boys maybe within a couple of days.
Yeah.
Edmonds was beautiful. He really knew it. And he compared it, because I couldn't make this up. He compared Sam Phillips to Looking for Elvis Presley.
Yeah.
He loved this music and he knew it. And he loved that he was someday, if I could find American guys who look good and sing good and have the attitude and know that it's not a dusty old record, but it's not brand new either, and it was completely organic, and it really was the right choice. And we went in, quickly recorded it, because I think every band, the first record is what you've been playing in your
live repertoire
show. Yeah. And what we didn't have was Runaway Boys, which we wrote then and there. We had Straight Cash, we had Rock This Town, and a few others.
But you know, it's amazing.
We didn't have Runaway Boys, which was the modern, I think that was the game changer, because that's what modern rockabilly, for lack of a better, will now be defined by.
Yeah.
Because it was current, but it was classic, one foot in the past, one foot moving forward, all that stuff. And that was the first single, and it was very successful right away.
And you and Brian wrote that song.
It was, yes.
Yeah. Co-wrote that. That is still one of my favorite songs. Yeah, I love that song so much because it just explodes.
Mm.
You know?
It's got a slap bass, but a modern way of recording it. It's got, a big drum sound, but it's got a classic element to it.
Yeah.
And, of course, the guitar sound is Brian's own. And Edmonds really knew how to do it.
He knew how to capture that feel.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I felt the urgency of a live performance. That's what I got out of that,
Because
it's a great song, great lyrics, great hook. With the title, but it felt so vital when it came out, and it still does. I mean, it's great. I love listening to that.
And it was about us, kind of.
Yeah, because you were Runaway Boys. You guys were. And I just love that. I mean, to me, taking that kind of chance and doing that is just so cool. And it's crazier times these days. I wonder if you could do that as much. You know,
it'd be hard to.
It's a different world.
Yeah. I mean, it can still be done. I think you can still go somewhere and make a change, go to New York or go to London or go to LA. I think you can.
Yeah, you absolutely can. It depends on, you gotta be ready. You gotta be ready though to make any sacrifice if that's what you want to do.
I think you have to be young.
Yeah, that's for sure. Right, exactly.
that's
incredible.
You can't be used to anything too good. Although the three of us had nice upbringings. We weren't poor in New York. We were bourbon kids and, everyone had drum lessons and everyone had a drum kit. So, my parents were cool. Lee's parents were cool. Brian's parents were cool. I mean, everybody was cool and well looked after. But we really had a vision, and we, without knowing how to even put it to words, we knew that we had to leave in order to, make it to the way that we wanted to have it. Yeah,
yeah, and it worked out really well, and it was interesting. It was the same thing with like when Blondie went over and became big there first, and then came back to New York and to America. I love there's a story, too, about when you were getting played on import, like by Rodney Bingham-Hymer, some of the folks over here at K-Rock back in that period of the beginning of the 1980s. And when you guys got to, L.A., you had no idea you were like people were going to be lined up down the streets to see you play.
No. What, when we made a record contract in England, and a few of these things is very standard fare.
Yeah.
When a band signs in England, your contract is based out of London and it's based out of the parent company there. So your record deal is usually for Europe, Japan, Australia.
Yeah.
But not the U.S. It's called ex-U.S., meaning except U.S., right?
Yes.
Not formerly. A label in England doesn't really want to be responsible for having to break the band in the USA, which is it's more expensive because there's more travel. The beautiful thing in Europe, you can go from Amsterdam to Paris in the same day. We lived in London. We went to Amsterdam, made a TV show. We would go to Paris and play a gig and come home the next. It's things are closer.
Yeah.
And more tied together. To come to the U.S., it's so big.
Yeah.
And it's much more regional.
Yeah.
Especially then.
Right? Especially then because, like literally,
radio.
Right? All there really was, it was radio. It was, pre-MTV. MTV was just about to start.
Exactly. So we didn't have a USA record contract.
Yeah.
So there's a few people in every city, especially LA, that were playing the record on an import. And the first people to play it on import were guys called Flo and Eddie.
Yeah,
who had played with Frank Zappa.
Right, and they were part of the Turtles. It was Howard Kaler and Mark Fullman, who
exactly.
are great singers, by
they
the way.
They had met us on a television show in Germany or France, and they came back to the States with the 45.
Yeah.
And they started playing it on Import Alley. That was a show on cable. So that's why initially the Stray Cats were misperceived as being a band from England because it was being played on import and it was like a UK label and we were doing all these gigs outside of America. So the first time we came to LA, which was a stopover on our way to Australia or Japan or somewhere you would stop, we stopped in LA. And we had booked a gig to help pay for the airfare or to, whatever the stopgap measure was. We stopped here and booked a gig at the Roxy and found out by going there that it had been played a lot on K-Rock in Port Alley and then a couple of the stations when they would do their indie kind of shows. This would have been 1981.
Yeah.
Now I think you would know if you were getting played somewhere. It's harder to keep something like that a secret.
But like back in those days.
So we turned up, never been to LA. I haven't moved too far from there. I was immediately in love with LA and I just stayed. But it wound up, we did the Roxy one night, two nights, three nights, and a matinee show. And it was bigger than we thought it would be because of the, the power of the import radio and indie radio. Then we went back to London because that's where we lived. Even though we were American, we still lived in London and got our stuff kind of. And then in that time frame, EMI decided to release the record because we had no record contract in USA. The deal with Arista was for exempt USA. EMI said, we'll take on that burden, got the rights from Arista, and they put the record out here. So then we kind of came back a few months later and just got in the bus and started
doing your thing and
touring in the USA. And it was, the coasts were very good. But where the gigs that we played then, it would have been 82, that's when you would have seen us.
Yeah.
It was the venues in each of the towns across the USA that would have fed from the people who listened to indie radio or the Sunday night show.
Yes.
So it would have been those people. So every town, I think, has a few hundred of those rocking people who are ahead of the curve.
Yeah.
And then maybe a year after that, MTV started and then it got on regular radio and it got much bigger. But the first tour of the USA for me is always very, very special because it was the real fans who had to go out and find it.
Yeah, it was an incredible time for you. That was so great, Jim. You know, so we talk about sobriety on the show too,
yeah.
And obviously, you and I both know. For me, being a club DJ all those years, playing in those new wave and alternative and rock clubs, and you being out and being a musician, and a lot of times alcohol is free, obviously, when you're playing at those gigs, you know, or someone's buying you drinks,
yeah.
Right? So, when did you decide that you were going to give up drinking? And was it because after a while it was just because it was just too available? And it's one thing when you're young to deal with the hangovers. What was it for you?
For
what
me,
was
drinking this? Just kind of stopped working. I stopped drinking in 1990. So
you took your last drink where, at the Roxy here?
Yeah. The Roxy, on yeah. the Rocks, another famous thing at the Roxy. I probably could have stopped a year before that. I remember trying to one time and, you know, making X on the calendar.
Yeah.
And lasted the week, whatever it was.
Yeah.
But I think I was just officially, you know, spent. I wasn't getting fired from anything. It was kind of business as usual. And I just, I was drinking guy. I wasn't drug guy. I don't know if I drank as much when I was 19 or 20, 21, 23, 20. I found my late 20s that it was just harder.
Yeah.
And I was somehow drinking more than I remembered and a bit harder to do it. And if you're anything like me, the only way that I liked anything in life was that if I could do it first thing in the morning.
Yeah. Early in the morning and do as much as you can.
I woke up and drank.
Yeah.
And I used to have a little plan that start off with a beer and then go to a nice lunch and have a white wine and then, you know, I'll have a cocktail around 6 and then, you know, nice wine at dinner. It never really worked out that way.
Yeah, no, I know. I always had those plans of stopping.
Drank two beers and like was wasted the rest of the day. And if there was a gig, I wouldn't have the two beers in the daytime. I would white knuckle it and be hungover and kind of nervous, that kind of feeling that you're made of glass.
Yeah.
It drops you.
Yeah,
and it really wasn't a conscious, like, I got to stop. It was one regular day of, you know, I drank the night before. And I would, especially when I was off, like the record was finished, the tour was finished, like the first 2 or 3 days after that cycle of that, I would just go for it.
Yeah.
You know? And this was another one of those occasions. And after, you know, drinking for 2-3 days straight, I just woke up one day after having been at the Roxy the night before and like 1,000 times before. I left my key with the valet parking guy. Luckily there I knew them, but it could have been anywhere, you know. And have to take a taxi to get your car because I wouldn't drive drunk. I kind of knew that much. So, but it was still a whole rigmarole of the day. Wake up, holy mackerel, try to make yourself look somehow presentable and then call a taxi to try to, and then piece together where you were the night before. Oh, was that place over on there? Yeah, going there and hopefully the valet parking guy was, if not call the club, wait for somebody to answer, then go. It was like, it was a hard way to live, kind of.
Yeah.
I know others have it worse, but that's what my life was. You know?
Yeah, it wasn't like a crazy bottom, but it was like you were just like you
it's the same level of I can't take this anymore.
Yeah. And so, that's the thing. I mean, it's just like we get to a point where it just stops working, right?
Yeah. Exactly. So that day I had kind of woken up and retrieved my car and I said, That's it, I'm not doing this anymore.
Yeah.
I just said I'm not doing it.
Did you ever go to meetings too?
Oh yeah. Positively.
Yeah, yeah.
Positively.
I'm totally immersed in that. You know, it's great for me, recovery and sobriety, and I love that.
And I had a friend who was a musician guy as well, and I would always hear him talking about meetings, and I didn't quite know what it was. And of course, before you do it, you think it's all, you know, doing that. That's for, you know, loser. That's for quitter.
Yeah.
Whatever the.
Yeah.
Before you know.
Everybody thinks so differently. They think it's a cult. They think it's this. They think it's like, this depressing thing, which it doesn't have to be. I mean, we're having a great time. You and I are both, you just got off tour. we're loving life and we're into music and we're.
I went in London, which I've done 100 times. I just, as you know, place I know, I pop my head in there. Okay, we have a meeting now. Oh, it's an NA. Okay, that's fine.
It doesn't matter which
fellowship. It doesn't really matter.
As long as
the
fellowship is it's a 12 steps and it's.
Yeah. And you sit there and there's at least one other person that can relate to what you're doing.
Exactly. You know? It's very strict.
So I called a friend of mine in LA that I knew had went to meetings, and the next day he came and got me and took me here in LA. And I didn't see depression. I didn't see, you know, your biggest fear is that you can't drink anymore.
Yeah.
And then your second fear becomes, it won't be fun anymore. You won't be fun anymore. You're not going to be I'm the lampshade on the headstand on the table guy, you know, that, well, maybe you have to find a different way to be amusing or, you know, so this is all a process. So I went one time, and before I knew it, I didn't go 30 and 30. I did 5 a week for the longest time.
Yeah.
There was a little circuit in the same way that you would go to certain
bars,
you know,
and clubs.
You would go to certain, you know,
go to meetings.
The log cabin on Tuesday. Yeah. And then, like you would know, you see people you know, and even if you don't know them, you see that there's a certain fellowship, see that there's a good time going on. And it was hard. It's not like you just go in and it's easy and that's the end of it. As soon as I started to feel better, 2, 3, 4 days, right, until you settled in, then you're at that spot where it really wasn't that bad. I can do it. This time I know to not mix the wine with the tequila. Okay, this time I'll only drink beer and I'll wait till the nighttime. Whatever your head tells you to convince yourself that it's okay to do it again. This time, that time, I didn't do it.
Yeah.
I was white knuckling for a little while, but then I kind of got it.
Yeah.
That it was easier. I can't say it's a magic formula.
Yeah.
But for me, it just took that last time, that last bottom, falling down on the sidewalk, not knowing where my car was till the next day, somebody helped me out, re-piecing my evening back together.
Yeah, I used to hate that part of it, like, you know, waking up and not remembering how the night ended, that blackout.
Yeah, I didn't have a complete blackout ever. Like, I knew that I'd been to the, you know, I was at the studio, and then on the way home,
it's just more spotty,
you know. And I knew that my car wasn't there. And it wasn't even like the worst time. Everyone the next day, no, you weren't that bad. It was, and I just didn't drink. I went to the studio the next day. I just didn't drink. I kept it kind of to myself. Then after 30 days, or 15 days, or 17, they meaning the rest of the world, no one specific. Think that you're going to do it again. Oh, it's just another phase this guy's going through. It's like, you know.
Yeah.
You know, kind of like how you switch from beer to wine or to cocktail. You know, like, he's just doing this for a while.
Yeah. Oh,
like it's another fad.
Yeah.
But it wasn't. It just stuck to me. And after maybe, I was a bit trial by fire because 30 days, 60 days, we were traveling. And I remember through an old fellowship of people in L.A., I took a directory with me because a couple of people I knew had been to Australia, had been to Japan, and they had it was an old-fashioned
meeting book.
Yeah.
It had all the meetings.
But not the thick one like in LA.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, there
these
was
were more like pamphlets or something.
Yeah, exactly,
you know?
Right.
Yeah.
Exactly right, which I carried around and then returned because it was like souvenirs for them. I somehow did that, but I went in Japan. I found English-speaking meetings. I went to Australia, gave them their pamphlets back, and then I was on the road a lot, and in the same way that on a tour with a bunch of people or at a job, whatever, you somehow would seek out the other person or two that was the same as you.
Yes.
You'd somehow, you would see someone who was in the hotel bar before lobby call who was having a beer.
Yeah.
In the dark of the hotel bar at 11 a.m. before you were leaving at 12. You find each other.
Yeah.
And then in the complete same thing reverses that, on any tour, I would find somehow there was someone who was always sober.
Yeah. That's what
one of the guys on the crew. Well, for us, we've been the guys on the crew. Like there was someone, or the promoter's representative who was on this part. Somehow, some way, you would find that other person. And I went to meetings all over the world, all the time.
That's fantastic.
Yeah,
I love that.
And it was
that.
Pretty much. You don't have to tell anyone. It's no one's concern.
Yeah,
really.
And I think it'll just
not even
you're
hiding anything.
Yeah.
And I'm happy to tell anyone, and I always was. It's just
yeah,
and. Really,
now you're 33 years. I mean, yeah. 33 years.
Yeah. One foot in front of the other, one day at a time. I believe all of that. I was kind of maybe fortunate that all the bumper sticker kind of slogan stuff made and makes complete sense to me.
Yeah.
One day at a time. You can't drink for the... Because I never sat down and said, I'm going to be wasted for 11 days in a row.
Yeah, it certainly didn't say
it
that.
It just happened that way.
Yeah.
So in the same way, I got it that you're not going to say, I'm going to be not drinking for 11 days in a row. You just one at a time, and all of a sudden, okay, there's 11 days. Okay, all of a sudden there's 36 days. However it is, I kind of looked at it the same way in reverse, and it made sense to me.
Yes.
You can't drink the seventh drink unless you drink the first one. I get it. You know?
Yeah, absolutely.
Like kind of a slow light bulb moment, like turning on the dimmer switch. Not on or off, but I was getting it.
Yeah.
And then at some point, you know, you get a little bit of a spiritual vibe from it. It doesn't necessarily have to be a church vibe or, you know, a religious vibe. It's a fellowship.
Yeah. You know? The spiritual side of just changing your life, making it a positive.
Yeah. I think if you read the the blue book, the big blue book, there's elements of every organized religion in there. It's all the good kind of things, you know.
Yeah.
It's, you know, I think it's ultimately about being of service and keeping your own side of the street clean at the same time. And kind of before you know it, you're a little bit more of a useful to the world and kind of to yourself as well.
Oh yeah, trying to be the best version of yourself you can be in. Being of service is so important, you know, being in just trying to, it's that progress, not perfection thing they talk about, which is great, you know?
And it, for me, and just about everyone I've ever met, it becomes easier. I got to go pick up that guy. I said I would go do that thing. Oh, man, then I got to stop on this. It's like, I'm going to go give so-and-so a ride.
Yeah.
Go pick him up on the way to the thing. It's me, because me easily, I'm the grumpy New York, Irish, everything is a drag.
Yeah.
No problem. You want that? I can be there in one step. But I naturally, just over the years, everything's not really a big deal. Not only that, but it becomes a little bit more fun and it's easier. That's my experience.
I mean, yeah. And I'm having a lot of fun in sobriety. Now I have 3 years and 3 months this week.
Anything's possible.
And I love it, man. It's just, you know, it's, and I have so many great friends that are part of the program or that are living their life a different way. And you remember everything and you enjoy the music, you know. Not that we didn't enjoy it then, too, but we really remember all of it. And that's the great thing about being present.
Yeah, I think it makes the best parts of you better.
Yeah.
Right? And then, I don't know if it's a strong word or not, but heals the things that are, you know, incorrect or broken a little bit.
It definitely does. It helps you build and, you know, kind of work on those things that they call character defects. And it's great, you know? I think it's amazing. And you, as an example, I see it. I see the way you're of service and great to your friends. And we have a lot of mutual friends. And I love the fact, you know, I've gotten to be there for some incredible things. Not only going back to being a kid and seeing you live, but being there, your wedding celebration that you had with Jenny, which was so awesome.
Fantastic. At the Whiskey A Go Go, where I got wasted 1,000 times.
I know, we were all sober that night, right? Yeah. So we were rocking.
Fantastic.
It was great.
My beautiful wife, Jenny V, plays in Eagles of Death Metal, one of the best rock and roll bands out there. And we had... Again, I think for me, certain things about being long time sober, things that would maybe be things that once daunted us are now, you know, there's some quote from the book, but things that would have normally kind of thrown you are like no big deal. We
can actually understand
them. To be married,
like,
where I met my beautiful wife on Sunset Boulevard, where she had come after her performance at the Roxy with the Eagles of Death Metal, and I was there with another mutual friend of ours, and not there to see anything in particular. A friend of mine was involved with the show. I went to the Rainbow 1,000 times before, the Roxy, where I had taken a last drink 30 years before that. Right? So you can hang out and have fun. I owned nightclubs the whole time I was sober. It's really, I don't want anyone to, you know, to do it badly, but if you want to have a drink and have fun, that's good. We have a business from it.
Exactly.
It's a social
thing. Well, there's a lot of sober people I know that are in the business at work
for sure.
Around and with
for sure.
alcohol because there's, you know, other people don't have the same
No one has to
issues.
Get wasted like you know, me every time I did it. So so I met my beautiful wife, and it was an opportunity that if I was, it was a long time ago, but if I was at the Rainbow with my rocking dudes wasted, I wouldn't have attracted my wife, or wouldn't have, you know, it wouldn't have been even a thing, right? So, again, it's, you don't have to stop having fun.
Kind of thing.
You can still be the same best part of yourself.
Yes, I agree 100%.
And be present for it. So, fast forward a few years, and we were set to get married at Beverly Hills City Hall, and then have our party at the Whiskey, the same thing. And pandemic happens and everything is closed. So we don't do that. So quietly, we get in touch with the city, who renewed certain licenses.
Yes.
And we were able to get married on Zoom.
Yeah.
In our house. But he can't have the party yet. So I had to fast forward until the things are open, and then when things were open, everyone's schedule was busy because making up for lost time, certain tours happened. So we waited. It was much later than we wanted to have a party at the Whiskey. And with all of our rockin' pals, including you, we had Sex Pistols, we had Clashes, we had Green Days, we had everybody there.
Yeah, and guys from every band, Fred Armisen, you know, Jeff Skunk Baxter, you're from Doobie Brothers, and still you didn't lose your neighbor.
Yes.
We had our whole gang there.
Yeah, we had our whole gang there, which I can't say 100% that in the past, certainly before I joined, if I wasn't of right mind, comfortably in my head, these things would have been a big deal. Oh, I got canceled. Oh, the world got canceled. My wedding got canceled. It was just another thing to let's make lemonade out of lemons. You know what I mean? Let's make a great time out of something that you would think would be sour, you know? So we just had that a couple of months ago, and it's...
And we had such a great time that night. It was such a great celebration, and good to be able to get together with you guys. You know, it's amazing. In 2019, you know, Stray Cats celebrated 40 years.
40 years, pretty.
It's mind blowing, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. At this point, let's talk about some of the other great projects that you've had too, because you've done so many cool things. We talked about Lemmy before, and your longtime friendship with Lemmy while he was alive, and Headcat. Tell me a bit about that.
Headcat was born from Lem and I know each other since 1980. He was at the first handful of Stray Cats shows, and he was a great fan of rockabilly music. The first night that we hung out was after Stray Cats gig, or one of the other nights that we were hanging around the places that we would have played at, and Lem was there, asked me if I knew a certain Gene Vincent record, and I didn't know that one, and he was kind of half annoyed and half, you know, couldn't believe it. We went to his place. He found the record amongst all of his crazy things. He had a reel-to-reel that he recorded of the BBC Radio 1 of Gene Vincent's performance. He knew where it was. His, you know, wackiness. He knew where it all was. And in the early days, we would party. And fast forward a few years where... we would always stay in touch. Anytime the Stray Cats played in London, he would come. I moved a few years after that back here to LA. Lem would come on tour. Eventually, in the late part of the 80s, early part of the 90s, he moved to LA and moved to near where I live, West Hollywood. My back gate opened up to his street, so I could see the front of his house, and I could see his pirate flag in his window. And I knew he was home. I'd whistle up. A New York taxi cab whistle up to his house. He'd come to the window. What are you doing? I'll come in. So our thing was based on friendship for the longest time. And here's a good one that I had stopped drinking in 1990.
Yeah.
And Lem and I partied a lot together. And he didn't even actually realize that I didn't drink or party anymore. Because it wasn't what our friendship was based on.
And that's like, great, right?
One of the times, this was in the early days, like by the time he moved to L.A., I was already, you know, sober a few years. And then he didn't even really notice. And then we, Headcat started. I was contacted about doing one song for a tribute record to Elvis Presley. And I knew that Lem was a big Elvis Presley fan. We went into a studio, recorded one of the tracks. We did it in half an hour. But we had a full day at the studio booked. Well, let's do this one. Let's do that one. Okay. Let's try. Ask the engineer, you here tomorrow? Yes, let's come back tomorrow. Okay, and before we knew it, over the course of a couple of weeks, we had a Headcat album. And during this, I think at some point, yeah, we would go out every night, and we were probably at the Rainbow or someplace, and Lem asked me what I was drinking. I said, Lem, I haven't had a drink in like 10 years or 7 years. And he said, oh, yeah. Oh, that's all right. And it didn't matter. Some peeps that you were friends with, you never really saw them again when you stopped drinking.
Yeah, they're yeah,
for me,
exactly.
Not that many of them.
Yeah.
They were party pals.
Yeah.
And a lot you see, maybe momentarily they weren't your pal.
Yeah, right.
You know, all the, you know, the gang we're talking about, people come in and out of it, right? And when someone comes in, hey, man, and that's when you're able to be of help.
Yeah.
You know, not even by saying or just by being you. Well, Slim Jim can do it, right? You know, Matt can do it. It's, you know, you're just there by an example in a funny way. But to me, it was a little bit of, again, not a light bulb moment, but a slow fade in moment. I realized 100% for sure that that's not what my friendship with Lem was ever based on.
Yeah.
It was based on the love of rock and roll, and that was the, you know, seed of it when we stopped partying together. It didn't matter.
Yeah.
Didn't change at all.
Because you still had that connection, that love of rock and that thing, that mutual appreciation of it, which is so great. I remember when you did Phantom Rocker and Slick too.
Yeah.
I thought that was cool because Earl Slick, I was obviously familiar with his work with Bowie on David Live and playing with people like that. And I thought he was a great guitar player.
Slick is still my friend. I spoke to him not that long ago. I would love to do something again with him. He was, another longtime sober guy.
Watching him, like, when I listened.
Not when I met him.
Yeah.
He was actually ahead of me. When I started working with Slick in 85, I was like, still working. I was in a in a good groove, you know? And Slick didn't drink. It's funny. And, again, it was one of those things that I like to be proven is the right word or ultimately realize that, that your very tight relationships in life aren't really and weren't really based on that.
Yeah, it wasn't. The ones
I was drinking, Slick wasn't. We made an album and did a lot of work that was brilliant and had a lot of adventures, right?
Yeah.
He wasn't drinking and never really said anything. I guess I must have turned up enough and played well enough that it was never particularly an issue, you know? I kind of started getting wacky after with Slick, you know, when we weren't together at that point. And then now we're both longtime sober. It just kind of reinforces to me. And now it's a better, you know, relationship with, for me, everyone that I'm not drinking and that's not part of my day. It takes up a lot, big part of your day.
Yo, it does. Well, that's what I found. It was taking up too much time. And also, it's like having a second job at times, just trying to keep it maintained.
In your head, doubting the universe and, you know, to yourself, you know, everyone's against me. Everything is against me. All I want to do
is everybody else's fault.
Everyone else and everything else.
Everything else. Until you realize you start owning it. You know what I mean? Your own behavior.
And it's easier.
It is. It's so much
easier.
Because
that's the thing for me that I can do something about.
Coming from an honest place is like the best thing,
I can
thing
do
too.
That. Me, no problem.
Yeah, which I love.
I don't have any sway over anyone else particularly, but that part I understood, that it was an inside job, that it was your that it was yourself that could not take the first drink. That all of it made sense to me.
Yeah,
and continues to make more sense the longer I go along.
which is so great. And, you know, we were talking about, like, rock and roll legends that we've loved. Talk about Jerry Lee Lewis, right? You played with Jerry Lee as well.
Yeah.
Tell me about some of the rock legends that...
Well, Jerry Lee, I can't say that I really knew him.
Yeah.
I definitely worked with him and was on stage with him a number of times, a few tours worth of times. He was a different guy, you know.
Yeah.
He was older than me, and for sure. I can't say that I ever knew him, and I can't say 100% for sure that from time to time that he knew who I was.
Yeah, because of his age.
I know that he was, you know, I mean, it never came down to that, but I never said to him, do you know that was me who played drums with you? I think he would probably say that he did. Well, I know that boy. I'm not 100% sure that he knew it was me time to time.
Yeah.
When we did do it, James Burton was doing, who's still my friend, the greatest guitar player way up there, right? James Burton. He remembered James, but I think he was, because those guys came up together in a funny way. But Jerry Lee was brilliant. He's the killer. Every now and again, during the gigs, it would be on, and I would hit, like, that's James Burton, that's Jerry Lee, that's me. A couple times a night, it would be awesome. But the last time I spoke with Jerry Lee, I did get in touch with him, and I've been doing a documentary about the history and the continuing influence of rockabilly music that's going very, very well. You'll all see it on TV soon enough. And that I got in touch with Jerry Lee about a year or so ago, and I asked him to do an interview with me. Yeah. And he said, I'm doing my own documentary, boy.
That's what he said.
I said, okay, Jerry.
All right, That is funny. I met him at MTV, and he was there for 120 minutes. With Rollins was there. And I remember walking him out, and he was really gentleman. He goes, those kids sure love that MTV.
He was a beautiful guy. I loved the right conditions, you know.
And he spoke to me, and he called me, yes, sir. And I was like, Jerry Lee's calling me sir. I should be calling Jerry Lee sir.
He called me son or boy.
I guess because he was a little bit overwhelmed that I was the guy looking after him while he was at MTV that time, but it was still classic, you know?
That's awesome. The fact that he did it is, you know, MTV, I mean, it's not scripted or anything what we do here.
Yeah.
It was a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And I think it was a very large cultural phenomenon.
Yeah.
Which anyone wants to bemoan that, you know, it was only good for this amount of time. I don't care about any of it, right?
Yeah.
It's when it was happening and the you know, the concept and the idea and then the practice of MTV was one of the most beautiful things ever. And I think important.
Yeah, 100%.
Because there was no way for a lot of the world, USA, to, I think we talked about this, that there was going to be a certain amount of indie people in every town.
Right, so there's pockets where you would get airplay only.
Yeah. And then in L.A. we did well. New York, we were from there.
Coast.
Like a couple of places that maybe like Detroit that were a rockin' town kind of thing. But for anyone to turn on after school and see different, a lot of places didn't know a guy with an earring.
Yeah.
They didn't know a guy with a different hairstyle. They didn't know a guy that wore creepers or pink pants. It became a cultural touchstone.
It did.
For tolerating, for openness to other ideas and all that. I really think that anyone who's got a bad attitude towards anyone who wants to get dressed up or be alternative has no excuse because there was MTV.
Absolutely.
Because important. And we loved them all. We were friends with Mark, JJ, of course, Nina, Martha.
Yeah, absolutely. All the
Alan,
originals. Yeah.
We were all friends.
Love those guys.
You would stop in there in the old days. Let's go to MTV. Okay. Yeah. You'd go there.
Yeah, and hang out with them.
It was a good, important thing, I think, for rock and roll.
I agree. And I stay in touch. I'm good friends with Alan and Mark. So
totally.
I love those
guys. We love Twitter, right?
Yeah.
That's what we stay in touch with everybody.
Yeah. And you know, we need to talk about your charitable works too. I love the Love, Hope, Strength Foundation. Can you talk to me about that and what it does for cancer research?
Love, Hope, Strength is something that I can really say that I'm just a part of. The main guy there is Mike Peters. speaking of old MTV days, he was
and
in
we
the
love
Alarm.
Him from the Alarm.
Yeah,
and you played. You've done other jamming projects with him as well.
Yeah, yeah. We had a group called Dead Men Walking, which was a collective, I guess you would call it. We would do gigs. Captain Sensible from the Damned, Glenn Matlock from the Pistols, Bruce Watson, Big Country, Mikey Boy, Peters, myself, Billy Duffy from the Cult. We would have a traveling gang, and we would do tours. Everyone would do a few of. We were like loud acoustic, I guess.
Yeah,
the right way to put it. Versions of everyone's hits.
Yes,
and then a couple of covers that everyone, Eddie Cochran, like everyone could agree on. Kind of
yeah.
Thing. Mike is the.
He's a survivor of cancer.
He's the cancer survivor, and yes. He organized the foundation called Love, Hope, Strength with his wife, Jules, and their other pal, James Chippendale, who's
and they
who's
did
our
that
friend.
Unbelievable Mount Everest climb.
Yes. He got in touch, and we, a gang of us, about 30 people, did Mount Everest. Let's talk
about that. It was like you and Glenn
Tilbrook.
Glenn Tilbrook from Squeeze.
Who's my other friend, the Strictly.
Who, by the way, how can you not love that Squeeze record? Those are great.
Glenn Tilbrook's one of the greatest guys ever. I think he can sing and play and write and shred.
I love that.
As good as anyone ever.
Yeah.
He's way up there. So the little core group was Mikey Boy Peters, Glenn Tilbrook, Cy Kernan, and Jamie West Oren from The Fix.
Yeah.
It was a wacky, organic gang.
Alex Coletti, who
was partners with Mike, who was, you would know Alex, he would...
Worked at MTV with me for years, and we're still friends, yeah.
Unplugged was his...
He did all the unplugs.
He invented it, right?
Yeah.
Alex was friends with Mike, and we all knew each other, and how that exact gang of people wound up together, I don't...
But the beauty of you
I
guys
don't know.
Climbing
but it was
Mount
Mike Peters
Everest.
Was the guy who organized it all. Yes, and with a few of my other friends, my pal Gary Renucci, who was a former soccer player for Scotland, who drank too much in the 80s as well, and through like injury and drinking too much, he stopped playing pro soccer, and he went into the building game, stopped drinking, and he went into the construction game, and one of the most successful construction people in London.
Yeah,
you see half the landmarks in London, this guy's company built them, and he's one of my original friends, doesn't drink.
Yeah.
Right? And his company got involved with me, and then Mike, and the organization. So again, there's a whole link right there, which I didn't even think of until now, of guys who don't drink.
Yeah.
Who can get something like that together. And
I mean, climbing Mount Everest is like something. I mean, how was that for you guys? There's video of you guys, like stopping and singing some songs like at different points. It's amazing to me.
It was really
with the altitude. I mean, how was that for you guys? Was it?
Oh, it was.
It was a beautiful thing because you were doing it after everything Mike went through.
Exactly. And Mike was my friend since 1980. That whole story we told about the Stray Cats and playing at the pubs and eventually making the record with Edmonds, et cetera, all that stuff. The first tour that we did was the winter, Christmas of 1980. And the opening act on that tour, we did 30 gigs, whatever, that are now, legendary gigs, but all the universities and this, the clubs, that in England, the opening act was The Alarm.
Yeah.
And we've been friends with Mike since then. The same people that we talk about and Mike was never a guy that would party.
Yeah.
So again, it's further proof that it's for yourself. And if you can be of service in any way, that's good. Mike and I, another guy that our relationship wasn't based on drinking.
Yeah. And I think that's great. Look at that friendship and how you guys were there for each other and the service and. I think it's an incredible thing. I just have a couple more things I know, but we got to talk about too. First of all, who is your favorite drummer of all time, or who are your favorite drummers? You are such a unique drummer and great performer. Tell me who you love. I mean,
there's a few that go into Sir Richard of Starkey. I think I would be.
Yeah, I mean,
the the way it's top of my list.
And he's been so helpful.
Stars, I got beautiful guy. To just the drums, and as an example, as a character, when you're a kid, you want to be one of them. Right?
Yeah, you want Beatles, you do that, or if you want to the
drummer.
Stones, right?
He's the drummer that sang, and he was part of their. They were a gang. That, you know, the reality of everyone's got their own, but that played out in public for you. You know, you wanted to be Hard Day's Night. You thought that was it, and it was always a huge effect on me. And then I met him a bit later. 1985 is when I met them. He and George Harrison, who was my friend, they did a lot for the drums as an instrument. You know, the drums. So Ringo's up there. Charlie Watts was another big influence on me in rock world, and the original American rock and roll drummers were kind of the biggest effect on me. Dickie Harrell, who played with Gene Vincent, the Blue Caps, that's him doing the screams and the drums on Bebopalula in those early records. DJ Fontana, who played with Elvis Presley, that's the most famous drum roll, best drum roll ever, I think, is the opening of Hound Dog.
Yeah.
That's DJ Fontana. A beautiful friend of mine who's in our documentary, RIP, is a cat named Charlie Connor, who was the original drum with Little Richard.
Yeah.
And that's him who came up with budget to budget to budget budget to budget to budget budget to budget to budget to bum 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 bum. You keep a knocking, but you can come in.
Ah, one of the greatest songs ever.
That Jimmy Page, he was a big fan of the rockabilly. That's where John Bonham was influenced, the original
Intro
most
to
famous,
rock and roll.
Exactly. That's from Charlie Connor.
Led Zeppelin, yeah.
So the original American rock and roll drummers like that, Jerry Allison, who played with Buddy Holly and the Crickets.
Love him.
Is another one. J.M. Van Eaton, who played on all those Sun records with Jerry Lee.
Yeah.
Fluke Holland, who was another guy who was a house drummer at Sun Studios. And then for me, all the guys that I aspired to, Tony Williams, Max Roach, Art Blakey, Billy Joe Jones, the guys who were the jazz drummers, the bebop drummers that were beyond my scope of, you know, but it had such a swing. So when I heard rockabilly music, it made sense to me because it has a swing and it rocks at the same time.
Yeah.
There's a very important guy, Freddie Belo, who was the house drummer at Chess.
Yeah.
Who did all that
all
stuff.
All the Bo Diddley records, Chuck Berry records.
Willie Big Eye Smith was another.
Little Walter.
Beautiful guys.
Yeah.
And it was just all of that went into the amalgamation of what I try to do.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm sure I'm even leaving a few out. But it's really my life is a love affair with the drums. And because the drums are such an amazing thing, you can figure out a way that all these people kind of have the same job.
Yeah.
Right? And every drummer loves every other drummer.
Yes.
It's just a fact that I've never met a drummer I didn't like, and I don't think there's one out there that say they don't like me.
You are all, so well loved all, out there.
It's personally
amazing.
As well as musically. Like drummers, we all have the same job. We all kind of know the deal.
Yeah, and really support each other. And speaking of, you know, Richard Starkey and Ringo, God, he's been so supportive of my sobriety, and I really appreciate him in such a
big
way.
He's a beautiful guy. For me, I'm going to be, you know, fan out again, as I always do, so it's not any, when I met Richard, I had been around already a little bit, you know? I met him when I was 24, 25 years old. We had been going, I met him through Carl Perkins.
Yeah.
Which... Right there, Carl Perkins had known the Stray Cats. I had already worked with him a bit. And then when Carl had a very, at the time, very under-the-radar television show special that we were asked to be on, and so were George and Richard. And no matter how cool you think you are, we had toured with the Rolling Stones. We had hit records, all that. It's different.
Yeah. Charlie Watts was cool to talk to as well.
Charlie Watts was beautiful. I would see him around in London, and I would see him around in L.A. He would go to jazz clubs, so if you kind of knew a certain drummer was playing, Charlie would go to a lot of them.
Yeah.
So organically, you can't plan to see anyone, but a lot of drummers go and see other drummers. Maybe there's 10 people there, but it's like, you know, who a few of them are going to be. And so I saw Charlie over the years, and I would see him in London once in a while, just organically, because we lived, I would stay in the same neighborhood that he lived in. But so when we met Richard, we kind of cool and all that, but there's something different about the Fabs.
The Beatles thing is just
there's only four of them, and then there was two of them, and it's a different thing, and I'm really honored and blessed that I was able to, through the drums and through then rockabilly music,
have a connection with them. That's so great, because for me, you know, I only, you know, became friends with Richard and Ringo, but through recovery, and then, you know, became friends now for years. Now it's been a few years, which is beautiful, you know. And then got to interview Paul and do the album specials with him, and that was also such a beautiful thing, you know. Like more than, and get to hang out and have conversations with Paul more than once, just talking to him. You know, I interviewed all the Stones, you know, when Charlie was still alive after that first throat cancer scare. I did a thing with the Stones for a bigger bang in 2005. Oh, I sat with all of them, except for Bill Wyman, because he left the band. It was beautiful, you know?
That's who I see. I see Bill. I saw him in London. He's beautiful.
And I love his special movie, his documentary, too. It's so good.
And he has a great new book out. It's London-centric, and then about the borough of Chelsea. That's a fantastic history of a certain part of a certain town.
Yeah.
That's, even if you don't know it, you probably will want to know it.
Yeah,
from
exactly.
It's like a book about a neighborhood. That's just, it's fantastic. If anyone gets Bill Wyman's Chelsea, I encourage you to check it out.
There's so many great stories. You know, I mean, I love it. I want to just, before we go, because it's so great, there's two things. I just want to mention, to tell everybody that you're the host of Rockabilly Rave Up on Little Steven's Underground Garage on Sirius XM, where you're known as the Honest Mechanic, which I love, right? But you play so much cool, your unique spirit and take on rock history and the connections between songs is something that I so relate to and love. Talk to me about.
That's my favorite thing I do. I'm an Honest Mechanic at Little Steven's Underground Garage, Sirius XM channel 21. That's right. It's me, your rockabilly buddy, Slim Jim Phantom, doing the Rockabilly Rave Up.
Yeah.
And Stevie Van Zandt, who's another friend of ours.
What a sweetheart he is. We love
Pal. We organically met him a number of years ago, and he has a very, very cool radio station on Sirius XM, Little Steven's Underground Garage, and asked me what I was doing, and he had, I kind of told him, there's no Beatles without Carl Perkins, there's no Stones without Bo Diddley, there's no Who without Eddie Cochran, just spinning my story of classic rock. When you're kids, that's what you hear first, and doing your homework a little bit and finding out who the original rock and rollers were. And I told Stevie my story, you know, got on my soapbox. And then after our little brief burst of conversation, he looked at me like Silvio. He Silvio'd me and said, all right, start in 2 weeks. I said, what? I didn't quite. I said, that's the show. I want it in 2 weeks. And I had beautiful. I said, okay. I had to learn how to go do a radio show. And now it's my favorite thing that I do. I like to show the influence, the continuing influence of rockabilly music. And we're doing a documentary about the same exact subject, how if you love Led Zeppelin, if you love the Beatles, if you love, it's all connected to Eddie Cochran and Chuck Berry and Jerry Lee Lewis and Bo Diddley and Little Richard and Carl Perkins. And that's the, you know, the beauty culturally as well as musically, everything is all related. If you like this, I'm going to help you like it even more by telling you a couple things I know.
That's great. And I love the show. And I love that you're out still rocking and rolling and doing what you do. Because when you play live, it's so great to see you. You just kill it. It's great.
Kidding me, buddy. We're all in this together.
Yes, absolutely.
You and me a long time.
Yeah, right, exactly. And I love it. Jim, thank you for coming in and doing this with me today.
You're kidding me, Matt?
You know, it meant the world to me.
You're my rockabilly buddy.
That's right.
Man, turn up, I'm here.
That's right, man. I love you and I love to get together and talk about music. We do it, you know, wherever. We've done it.
We do it all the time.
Yeah,
now
we
it's
do.
On the radio.
Yeah,
that's
exactly.
The thing. Everybody, I'm happy to tell everyone, we do this all the time. Yeah. Once in a while, it's on the radio.
Yeah, that's it. Because we love to talk music and talk about like the history of music and what we love and how it connects to everything now. It's just, that's who we are, because that's what our heart and our passion is in. You know, and it has been for so long. So I want to thank you again. Jim, it's so great to have you, man.
My pleasure, Matt.
It's a
big time.
Yeah, it was great. Slim Jim Phantom, everybody. This is Sound Sobriety and Success. I'm Matt Pinfield. Please make sure that if you like this episode, which I'm sure you did, check out the other ones as well. Make sure you hit like and subscribe to the podcast as well. It's been such a pleasure. I love doing this with Jim. And I thank you so much for listening to us and checking out the show. And we'll be back with you very soon. Thanks again. If you or someone you know is struggling with alcoholism or addiction, Music Cares operates a mental health and addiction recovery program that understands the challenges music professionals face, no matter where they are in their career. Learn more, including if you're eligible, at musiccares.org. That's musiccares.org.
Sound, Sobriety, and Success with Matt Pinfield. Produced by Jake Urbanek. Engineered by Darren Silva. Terrion Zeldo, Booking and Research. Susan Aksu Magarian and Robbie Gissell, Marketing. Sound, Sobriety, and Success is a Benstown McVeigh podcast production.